Welcome to the Christmas edition of the Machine Learning for Greenhorns lecture. Welcome. So it's the penultimate lecture of the course, and it's going to be like more like a free roaming lecture where we will be talking about some like more complex or I would say interesting issues. First, are there any questions, something you would like to know? Well, if not, then let's get to it. First, let's finish our clustering treatment. We talked about the k-means algorithm on the previous lecture, and we also talked about start discussing extension by using the multivariate Gaussian distribution. I have added some new images to the slides, so let me just illustrate, show you some more details. The multivariate Gaussian distribution is a generalization of the regular one, instead of the one number variance, we have the whole matrix, a covariance matrix, which describes somehow like the size of the distribution. So if the covariance matrix is an identity, then it disappears from the exponent, and what is left is nearly an RBF kernel, right? Because the probability of some point with respect to some mu to some center is proportional to the exponentiation of the norm of the distance of x minus mu squared divided by 2 and minus. So this is nearly an RBF kernel if you look at it. And what's interesting is to look at how the constant surfaces look like. Right, like what are the subspaces which have the constant probability in this probability density function. So in this case, these constant surfaces are just concentric circles or n-dimensional spheres which are centered at the mu. So the mu is the center of the cluster, and then the cluster is just a sphere which extends to all directions in the same way. So there is the visualization of a 2D version, and then the surface plot which shows the places with a constant value of the PDF. So that's the identity one. We can scale the identity covariance by some scalar number, sigma squared here. And what it does is that it changes the diameter of the circles, right? So you can make the PDFs or the distributions like either smaller or larger by multiplying the distance in all dimensions by a constant. So if you imagine that the clusters will be parameterized as these multivariate distributions, then if the covariance is an identity, then it will be just a sphere, and we can increase or decrease its size by multiplying this by a constant. Then we can think or consider the case where the covariance matrix is a diagonal one. If it's a diagonal one, then the PDF simplifies to this version. There is still xi minus mu I squared, but this time is just multiplied not just by 1/2, but multiplied by 1/2 times the eth element on the diagonal of the covariance matrix. So what does this, or what the constant surfaces look like? The constant surfaces are ellipsoids or ellipses, which are axis aligned, but these lambda ii numbers, like the number of on the diagonal of the covariance matrix, are the scales in the different axes, in the different features, in the different dimensions. Right. So by having just one number for the covariance, but having d numbers, the diagonal, we can scale the distances in the different dimensions independently. So that allows us to create clusters where we can just measure the distances in any way we want in the different ones. Now, in the most complex case, when the covariance matrix is a full matrix, what happens is that it will also allow to rotate these constant surfaces, these ellipses. If we have a covariance matrix, then it has got eigenvalues. It can be shown that they are actually positive eigenvalues. And if we look at the corresponding eigenvectors, then these constant surfaces, they look like ellipses which are centered at mu. Their axes are aligned with the eigenvectors, and the size of the of these ellipse axes depends on the eigenvalues, right? So it depends on it the same way as here, because if we have a covariance matrix, then the eigenvectors are just the individual dimensions, individual axes, and the eigenvectors are the numbers on the diagonal. But in the general case, the eigenvectors might be arbitrary, so we can get even rotated ellipsoids. So we can sum all this up to when we realize that this covariance matrix can be written as a square of the eigenvectors times the square of the diagonal times the square of the diagonal times the eigenvectors, right? This can be easily shown from the eigenvalue decomposition of the covariance matrix. And because the eigenvalues are positives, we can compute the square root of them. So even these square roots are real real values. So we can easily write it like this. And then if we do this, if we like compute the square root of the positive definite covariance matrix, then sampling x from the normal distribution with the mean mu and the covariance sigma is the same as sampling x from the standard distribution, which has zero mean and identity covariance, and then multiplying the individual dimensions by the lambda to 1/2. By the square root of the lambdas, right? So this is the scaling part, and then times u, which is the rotation part, and then finally we add mu, which moves it to some place. So the general distribution always look like the standard one, then squashed or extended, rotated, and moved to the center. This also is the case with the one-dimensional version, right? We can do the same thing. Then we multiply this n by the standard deviation, which is the square root of the variance. So in a sense, this covariance matrix has the same meaning as the variance, right? And when we compute the square root, then we can use it to like transform the results of the standard parametrization of the normal distribution. So this is something which I added to the slides, but it was not in the English lecture, so I just went through it. And let's get to the Gaussian mixture. Now let's compute clustering, where the individual clusters will not be just spheres of the same size as in the k-means, but they each cluster will be parametrized by a multivariate Gaussian distribution. Let's say that we have got n data points, each being a d-dimensional vector, and we get the number of clusters. And we parameterize kth cluster by center mu k and the covariance matrix sigma k. And then we can say that the probability of some data can be computed like this. We compute the probability of this data being generated by the kth cluster. So the probability of this data in this kth cluster. And this is multiplied by the priors bk. This density is always like summing to one, but if we cluster some data, it might happen that some of these clusters will contain smaller number of points, and some of them will contain considerably higher, a larger number of points. Now, this cannot be modeled by the PDFs themselves, because the PDFs only just measure the probability without considering some other distributions. So what we do is we have these priors PK, which tell us like the fertility of the clusters, like whether a lot of points are being generated from some clusters or a small number of points. So this is what we want to do. We will model the data points as a mixture, as a combination of K multivariate Gaussian distributions. In order to actually somehow compute this, or being able to work with this, we will do the same trick as we did with the K-means. So we will consider some latent variable vector Z, which will be the assignment of the points to the clusters. So the Z will always have just the values 0 and 1, and ZK means that some point belongs to the Kth cluster, right? So this is like one hot encoding of where a point belongs. And now, when we talked about this PK, then what these PKs are, well, they are the marginal distributions, like the probability that some point belongs to the Kth cluster, right? So this is how we define them usually. These are the marginal. So the probability that some point belongs to a cluster independently on where the point is, like a prior distribution of some point being generated by the cluster. So the overall model looks like this. We have these latent variables, which tells us where the individual points belong. And then we generate the points. We can imagine that we generate the points when we know to which cluster they belong to. And when we do it, then generating means really sampling from this multivariate distribution. So then with this model, we can actually come up with this equation by saying, okay, so the probability of some point can be computed like this. We will consider all possible latent variables, all possible assignments, and compute the or compute this probability. And if we do it, we actually get this result. So this is what we want to do. We want to, this is how we want to model the data. And our goal will be to come up with these clustering. So come up with these parameters with the priors, means, and covariances, so that the probability of the data in this model is the maximum one. So we will use the maximum likelihood estimation, actually. What we will do is we will try to minimize this negative log likelihood, where the likelihood, like the probability of the data given the parameters, can be computed like this. Well, for one given data point, is the probability of the data point in all clusters multiplied by the priors. And then we will try to come up with the mus, with the means, covariances, and the priors, in order to minimize this loss. The only problem is that it will be difficult to do. And the problem is that up until now, our losses usually were negative log likelihood. And now this likelihood, either it was the normal distribution or Bernoulli distribution, or it was a categorical distribution. All these distributions, they had specific form, right? They look like some constant times e to something. And now there are some x's here, right? E to, I don't know, fx. So when we were computing this log likelihood, then this logarithm and this exponentiation canceled, and the resulting losses were quite nice. For example, when we compute the logarithm of the normal distribution, we know that we get the mean square error, right? No logarithms and ever nice clean formulation. For the categorical one, we get the derivative of the softmax distribution, which is once again a nice thing. It's like the prediction minus the it is the cross entropy, but when you compute the derivative, then this logarithm and the exponentiation, they get cancel, and the derivative is very nice, and so on and so on. But here we have a logarithm of a sum, and logarithm of a sum cannot be simplified nicely. Even if the individual sums are exponentiations of something, then it's the sum and the logarithm just don't play nicely in this order. But anyway, let's try. Let's try computing the derivative of our loss. So what the loss looks like, it's the negative log likelihood, and the likelihood is the sum over all possible clusters, the prior of the cluster times the probability density of some point in this cluster. Now, if we compute the derivative with respect to the means first, then the minus is being kept there. Derivative of the logarithm is 1 over the value of the input of the logarithm, and then times the derivative of the inner function. So what the derivative of the inner function will be, well, this mu appears only in one of these densities, in the density of the kth cluster. So this normal distribution is actually exponentiation of something, right? So computing the derivative of an exponentiation function is the original function. So pk times the probability of the ith point in the kth cluster times the derivative of the exponent, right? So the exponent of the normal distribution in this case looks like minus 1/2 times x minus mu transposed covariance inverted x minus mu. So if we want to compute the derivative of that, then to do it exactly, we should compute the derivative one by one, the elements of this mu k, and combine the results. I will just show you what the results are. In a very naive way, this is something like x minus mu squared, right? But there is this covariance matrix here. But if it weren't there, then how would we compute the derivative? Well, we would say this is 2 times x minus mu, right? Times minus 1 because of the minus mu here. And this is what the result actually is when we really compute the results for one by one of the elements of the mu k. So this is the xi minus mu. This 2 cancels with this 1/2. This minus cancels with this minus, and this covariance is just being left there, like as a constant. I'm abusing the notation a bit because this is not a constant, this is a full matrix. But in the end, this is a vector, this is a matrix. So the result of that is again a vector, which is what we want, because we this full derivative should actually be a vector. Right, so this can be done in great details, but I won't make you do it. Solving this is actually difficult. So what we do is we this is like a long equation, and there are these funny terms here. So we will actually give them a name. We will call them responsibilities. This is R_ik. Now, if we do it, we can rewrite the derivative to this form xi minus uk. We can multiply by the covariance matrix, which will cancel this. Then we can split this Split this parentheses. So what we do is we get, this gets to the left side, so we get mu k times the sum of the responsibilities should be equal to x, oh sorry, to the sum of xi times the responsibilities. And from that, we get that these mu's should be a weighted average of the input points. Right, so what does this do? For each point x, we take its responsibility for the cluster k as a weight, and we compute a weighted average. Now, these responsibilities, what they do is they correspond to the probability of the point belonging to the kth cluster. Right? These latent variables, they are always just 0 or 1. But the probability of the ZK being 1, that doesn't have to be 1. It can be 0.5 or 0.9 or something, right? So this conditional probability, that's what these responsibilities are. Like we estimate we estimate them from the data. And how we do it? Well, this tells us what the probability is of the point being generated by the kth cluster. This multiplies it by the prior, so the chance that this cluster actually generates any data. And then we normalize this across all the clusters, right? So if one of these clusters is very close to the point, then the density of the point in this cluster will be very high. So the responsibility will be very high, right? So that's what we do. And now when we have the responsibilities, then here we compute the weighted average. So if some point seems to belong to some cluster, it will influence its center, its mean, a great deal. In the k-means algorithm, what we did is we worked directly with these assignments. So either they were 0 or 1. So you can imagine that our responsibilities in the k-means were directly these z's, so either 0 or 1. And then this would be a sum of points which belong to the kth cluster, right? Because this error would be just 0 or 1. So we would sum over the points which only belong to this kth cluster, and we would divide it by the number of points. So in the k-means, we did this as well. But if we have just non-zero, non-ones, but the full real valued responsibilities, we need to compute the weighted average of the point. So if some point seems to belong to two clusters, it will influence the means of both of them. Yep. Note that this mu is definitely not a solution to this loss being zero. The problem is that there are actually several mu's, right? There is one mu here, but there is mu here, and one of these mu's is also k. What we did is we kind of assumed that this mu k is not mu, but just some constant. And then we solved for this mu. For this mu, we got minimum, but it would be only minimum if we decreased this mu, but we didn't change these ones. Right, so we cannot solve this in one step, but hopefully it will allow us to use this solution iteratively. So we will do it once, twice, three, four, some number of times, and hopefully we'll be able to converge to some minimum. So this is for the mu's. We have some idea what to do. We will now do the same things for the covariance. The problem with the covariance is that it's technically quite complicated, because if you look at the PDF of the normal distribution, there is first the inverse of the covariance matrix, and then there is also the determinant of the covariance matrix. And what we need to do is we need to be able to actually compute the derivative of both of these. Well, I actually cannot do it from the top of my head. But if you would go through and compute the derivative, what you would get is the following result. We would compute the covariance for a single example. Right, this is the covariance matrix for a single example. That's what we did when we were computing PCA, right? And there was this matrix S, which was the covariance matrix, which was exactly this, like a sample covariance. And we combine it. And for example, in the PCA, we just compute the mean, right? But here we have the responsibilities. How likely it is that this ith point belongs to the kth cluster. So we compute an average, a weighted average of these covariance matrices. Right, so similarly to this mu, which is actually like a mean of the given points, but weighted by the responsibilities, the covariance matrix for the cluster K is again a weighted average of the individual data point covariances multiplied by the responsibilities. So the same style of the solution. And this leaves us only with the third set of parameters which we need to come up with, which are the priors. However, the priors are a distribution, so we need to do a constraint optimization. Well, we have done this many times already, so it is not a surprise. Because we want them to sum to one, we add the Lagrange multiplier times the constraint, which is sum of all the prior probabilities minus one, and then compute the derivative. We compute the derivative with respect to some pk. So what the derivative, what the loss looks like, the loss is negative log of likelihood, which is sum over all L of pi L, and the probability of point X belonging to the Lth cluster. So when we compute the derivative with respect to pi k, then it's one again, one over the value inside the logarithm times the derivative of the inside of the logarithm. So out of this sum, only the kth element will contain pk, and the derivative of this element with respect to pk is just this probability of xi belonging to the Lth cluster, kth cluster. Then of course we need to also compute the derivative of the constraint, which is just lambda. Only one of these p's pi's is k, the derivative of that is one, so one lambda is remaining. Yep. So what we do now, we multiply this by k, set it to zero, and if we do it, then, well, these are the responsibilities again. So our pi k is equal to minus lambda times the sum of the responsibilities of points to belong to the kth cluster. Now we don't know what the lambda is. It needs to be set to some value so that the constraint is satisfied. But instead of computing the lambda directly, we know that we need the pi's to be a distribution. But we actually know what the sum of the responsibilities of all the points and all the clusters are, right? The sum of the responsibilities of a single point is one because it's a distribution. If we have n points, it's n. So if we divide this sum of the responsibilities by n, we know that we get a distribution. So the final priors are the sum of responsibilities of the ith point belonging to the kth cluster divided by n, which definitely makes sense because if the responsibilities compute the probability that some given point belongs to the cluster k, so the prior is the like marginalization over x's, right? So if we sum all the probabilities of some point belonging to this cluster K over all points and then normalize, then that's what these priors should actually be, and it's true. So this was a lot of equations. Yeah. So I summarized them all on this slide where the full algorithm is spelled out. So we get the points, we get the number of clusters, and we need to first start with some parameters. So we need to compute the means, covariances, and the priors somehow. A common way how to do it is either once again to choose the means randomly, use identity covariances and uniform prior distribution. But I would say that the more common approach is actually to start by running the k-means algorithm, which gives us some cluster assignment. And then we use it as our responsibilities and compute the mu's covariances and the pi's using these responsibilities, right? So somebody gave us some assignment, so we use it to fit the clusters and continue. In any way, once we have initialized these parameters, then we will alternate two steps, similarly to the k-means algorithm, right? In the k-means algorithm, in the first step, we computed Zik, right, as being one if the ith point was closest to the kth center. So we updated the assignment in this step. In the Gaussian mixture, we don't do zero or one. So instead, we compute the responsibilities, the probability that the ith point belongs to the kth cluster. Then this step is sometimes called an E step, where the E is expectation step. So we compute an expectation. This does not look like an expectation much, but it actually is. Now, in the next step, what we will do is we will maximize the log likelihood. So we computed the derivatives and we update the means, covariances, and the priors using all the equations which we got. Hopefully, this in the k-means, we only did this first part, right? And we did it by going over the points which only belongs to this cluster K in cluster A, divided by the number of points in cluster K. So that's just a special version of this update. Right, but here where the responsibilities are not just zeros and ones, but they can be any real valued numbers. Yep. And this is sometimes called an M step, because like the maximization, where we maximize the log likelihood of the data. So let's look on some images. This is the data where each point is actually being generated, belongs to one of the clusters, but the algorithm doesn't know it. So the algorithm gets this unsupervised input where no information about the labels are present. And what it does is that in the end, it models the responsibilities in this way, right? So the model doesn't know whether these points actually belong to the red or green cluster. So it says, okay, it's like 50-50, but some of them are obvious. So these, they just belong to the red cluster with the highest probability. And for example, these points, they belong to the green one, right? They are close also to the red cluster, but the red cluster actually is narrow. So points here are much more likely to belong to the green one instead of the red one. These are the three multivariate Gaussian distributions, these three ellipsoids, these three clusters, and these are the prior probabilities. So these two things are what the Gaussian mixture algorithms can actually come up with using this input. And they like try to model this assignment, these latent variable sets. There is an example here on the same input as on which we saw the k-means example. Let's say we start with these two points with identity covariances. Then in the k-means, we just like divided the points with a fixed threshold, but here we compute the responsibility. So we can see that the points on the border are like violet one, because they are like 50-50% chance of belonging either to the blue or to the red cluster. Once we compute the responsibilities, that's the E step, we do an M step. So what we do is we move the centers of the clusters and their sizes and their priors so that they best explain the data which we have at hand, right? Then in the next step, we will do an expectation and maximization. You can see that the clusters moved a bit. The blue one shrank. The points here, which belonged a lot to the blue clusters, now belong more to the red cluster. On the other hand, the points which here belong to the red cluster belongs more to the blue cluster. And then if we do it five times, you can see that the cluster starts to move to these individual real chunks of data. And after 20 iterations, we have clustered the data. Well, in this simple example, very similarly as in the k-means algorithm, even if in the k-means algorithm the decision would probably go somewhere here. But we also have the centers and the sizes and the rod shapes of the clusters in question. The funny thing is that we actually have no guarantee that this converges somewhere. Right, because when we came up with the updates, these updates, they like assume that one of these mu's changes, but the other is being kept fixed. So this is not really an SGD or something, it's just some algorithm. So it would be nice to actually be able to see that the algorithm works. And in fact, it does, and this clustering algorithm is an instance, an example of the so-called EM algorithm, right? The k-means is sometimes said to be like a very simple version of the EM algorithm, and the Gaussian mixture is as well. There are also some other algorithms with names, but they generally are of this same class of algorithms. Maybe you've already heard about the AM algorithms. If not, that you will definitely heard about them even later. And in a sense, the EM algorithm is like simple on one hand and quite complex on the other. So to wrap your head around it, to understand what's really happening may take some time. So if you haven't made it yet, and it will be still not very clear after this lecture, then don't hesitate, don't despair. That's normal. You will see it multiple times again, and then slowly it will get better. So this is like a very quick introduction. You can see that it's marked as danger sum, so there will be some math here, which I will not expect you to know. But I think it's good to be like I like to see these things multiple times, and then hopefully you will like to get the right intuition about them. So the EM algorithm can be used if we have some observed variables x, so we have some data, and we have also some hidden latent variables z, which are unseen, and we have the joint distribution, right? So we can measure or evaluate what the probability of the x and z is actually. So this is what we have, and what we want to do is we want to maximize the marginal probability of x. So we want to compute the probability of the data without actually seeing the z's, right? But this probability is just computed as the logarithm of the sum of all the possible joint probabilities for all the latent variables. So this is what we want to maximize in the EM algorithm. We want to maximize the probability of the data, which is internally computed as the sum of the joint probabilities of the data and all possible latent variables z. That's what we actually did in the Gaussian mixture. These Zs, they are usually some membership of the data in to some set of groups, right? So it was a membership of a point in some cluster. Or maybe we can have documents and that we have topics. So these Zs would tell us what the topic of a document is, right? Whether the document is about sports or food or Christmas or something. So these latent variables could be this assignment. And then once we have the latent topic, we can generate the words in the document by sampling from some topic-specific distribution or something. And the problem with maximizing this is that we have got this logarithm and the sum, right? And even if this probability is nice, an exponential one, then the logarithm of sum can be like very difficult. It's very difficult to optimize. So the EM algorithm, what it does is that instead of optimizing this, we will optimize a different quantity, which will be an expectation with respect to this conditional distribution set given X of the logarithm of the joint distribution. So the EM algorithm, instead of optimizing this logarithm of sums, of a sum, it will maximize the expectations or sum of a logarithm. And that will be a good thing because now the logarithm is acting directly on the joint probability. So if it has some nice shade, it will cancel out and we'll get a nice result. And usually we can even compute this expectation analytically. So that's like the main trick. So let's look at what the algorithm really looks like. We initialize the parameters somehow. That's what we did in the Gaussian mixture. So we somehow need to came up with the means and covariances and the priors. So once we do it, we will alternate two steps, the E step, in which we compute this expectation with respect to the conditional probability of Z given X of the joint probability of the logarithm of the joint probability of X and Z. And then once we do it, we will run an M step, which will be the maximization step. So we will come up with the new parameters, which will maximize this expectation, right? So we are maximizing, instead of maximizing the logarithm of sums, we are maximizing the weighted sums of logarithms. If you like explicitly write what these probabilities look like for our Gaussian mixture, then you will get exactly the responsibilities here, and this maximization will give you the mu's and covariances and the priors exactly as we derived them in the Gaussian mixture. So this is like a generalization of that algorithm. But it's not obvious that it converges, because now when we update these W's, when we update the parameters, then it's true that this joint probability will increase, but these parameters, they don't change, right? When we compute the maximum, we don't move or we don't alter this parameter. So we alter only some of them. That's actually what we did for the Gaussian mixture. We came up with solutions for some of the mu's while imagining that the rest of the mu's are being fixed, right? So that's what we do. This conditional distribution is computed with a fixed set of parameters. And when we optimize them, we modify only the ones which belong here to the joint probability. But if we increase or if we change the parameters, then if we put them back here, it might happen that the loss will decrease. So there is no reason why the probability of the data themselves needs to increase. We know that the Q increased, but that's all. So it would be nice to see why it's the case. And it actually is the case, and it's possible to prove that after each iteration, not only this Q value will increase, but also the probability of the data will increase. So the algorithm will converge to some local optimum. So it will be like a different GD version. So we start by noting that the Px can be written as the joint probability minus the logarithm of the probability of the conditional distribution. That should be simple, because px or p, the joint probability of px and z can be written as the probability of x times the probability of z given x, right? That's how conditional probability works. And now if we add logarithms, right, we can see that this one is the joint minus the logarithm of the probability of the conditional distribution. Now, if we compute the expectation with respect to the conditional distribution with a fixed set of parameters, and what we get this on the left side. We are computing the expectation with respect to z, but z is not used in any way, right? So we can just take the value outside of the expectation, and then the expectation itself of the z itself is one, so it doesn't really change anything on the left side. And on the right side, we sum over z's of the probability and the joint probability, and minus sum of all possible latent variable z multiplied by this conditional distribution of this conditional distribution. And now, if you recall, this part is actually a cross entropy, right? The entropy is something like minus p log p, right? This is entropy. And if it is p log q, then it's cross entropy. So that's exactly what's happening here. So this is a cross entropy between the conditional probability with old parameters and the conditional probability with any given w's. So because this holds for any parameters, we can look at how the results look with the original parameters, the W old, right, the previous ones. So this Q, I didn't discuss this, but this value, that's the Q which we work with in the EM algorithm, right? This Q is the expectation of the joint probability with respect to the conditional probability. So this is just the Q. So now if we consider the original set of parameters, then this is the Q with both, with all of the instances of the parameter being fixed to the old version. And here we have the cross entropy of two same distributions. So it's actually the entropy of the distribution, right? Because it's the same in both places. So why we actually looked at these two values? Well, these two values will tell us how the probability of the data will change. This is the probability of the data in the previous iteration, and this will be the probability of the data in the new iteration. So we actually want this to be larger or equal to this, and that's what we want to prove. So what we will do is we will look at the difference, and we will hope to compute that this is non-negative. So what the difference looks like? We need to subtract the Q's, right? So we have the Q's. Here the parameters are W, and here they are the original version or original value of the parameters. And then we need also to subtract the cross entropies. So it's like the cross entropy for the parameters W and entropy using the W old. And now the cross entropy minus entropy. We know what that is. That's a KL divergence. So we rewrite it to a KL divergence and use the interesting or important thing that the KL divergence is always non-negative. So we can just cancel it out, and we know that the difference in the probabilities of the data is at least the difference between the Q values. However, during the M step, what we do, we find such a new version of parameters which maximizes this q value, right? So it's some set of parameters where this q is as large as possible. But that means that this value is actually greater or equal to this one, right? Because this is the value with one specific parameter, w old, though the previous ones. And this is any version which is larger. That's what we did, right? So if we improve the parameters, then this difference is a positive one. So it also means that the probability of the data also increased. So now we have our proof. And the important part was this scale divergence, right? Because this means that even if we didn't account for all the parameters in this value which we want to optimize, right? Even if we don't move or don't update these w's when we compute the maximization, then we cannot be hurt, right? Because this part, when we change the parameters, this will only increase. So even if we didn't consider the real w's here, then it's fine, because even if we change them, then this cross entropy can only increase. The cross entropy cannot go down than the original entropy, right? So it's not like it can hurt us. It can only give us something, right? If we now consider the new version of W anywhere in the equations, it can only increase the probability of the data. So woo-hoo, we are done. It was, of course, important that this was actually cross entropy. So what we needed to do is we needed to get rid of this value. And that's one of the reasons why we are actually computing the expectation regarding this distribution, right? Because then these distributions are the same, and this is actually a KL divergence, so it will cancel out. So this is what motivates the choice of this conditional distribution. Well, because if we choose this specific conditional distribution, then changing the parameters only in some places is not a problem, because if we then apply these changes to all other instances or other occurrences of these parameters, then we will only improve the likelihood of the data. Yeah, so this is a bit tricky and dense if you haven't seen it. So it's like a specific trick, but the specific trick which is repeated over and over in several algorithms. So it's good to have some idea what's happening, but you don't have to take it too seriously. If you want, you are free to forget it now. Yep. Yeah, so let's now get to a completely different topic. The interesting thing about this new topic is that people assume that the models or that this generalization error have this U-shaped curve shape. and that there is some like sweet spot for the capacity of the model where the generalization error will be the lowest. This came up because of the error decomposition, which I will show you closely, and it's sometimes or usually caused a bias variance trade-off. It has been known or accepted for nearly 30 years, but the interesting thing is that it turned out to be false for many or for some of the models. Well, not exactly false, but not exactly true as well, you will see. So it's nice to see like what the people actually like used as a data to come up with some conclusions, and then how they were able to realize that it's actually not the case. So let's start with the theoretical reasons why this generalization performance should actually look or could look like this U-shaped curve, right? So Consider a regression problem with the mean square error loss. So the loss is the expectation of the square of the error of the model prediction y and the Gold targets d. What we will now do is we will decompose this loss into several components. So first we will do a simple decomposition, which will deal with some inherent noise in the data. It can happen that for some input we have multiple targets in the data. For example, so I said it's a regression problem, but for example, for the classification, if we had some, I don't know, something like this, which looks both as a 5 and 6, then some annotators could say this is 5, the other would say it's 6. So we would get two different labels for the same input. But maybe the model or the data, the prediction doesn't depend only on the features. It may depend only on some unobserved features which are not captured by the data. So it can happen that the same, exactly same input has multiple targets. So of course we cannot fix this in any reasonable way, right? This is some error or some problem, which is contained in the data itself. So let's get rid of that first. Let's denote G to be the expectation of the targets for a given X. So this is like the best what we can do. Like if we have a fixed X, then and we have multiple targets, it's difficult to say what to predict, right? We have like contradictory information. So what we will do is we will predict G, which is the expectation of that, right? So now let's look at the loss. This is the mean square error. So what we will do is we will subtract this G and add this G. That of course we can do, nothing changes because we just added 0. And now we will consider this to be A, we'll consider this to be B, and compute the A squared plus 2AB plus B squared, right? So we have got this, this here, then this A and this B and this B squared. Now, what are these quantities? The most interesting is this one. This is the difference between the real data target and the expectation of the target for a given point. So ideally, this should be 0, right? If there is a unique target for each point, then this Gx is just 1t, and that's exactly this t, so it will be a 0. So this is some kind of like a data error. The first one is the mean square error between the model prediction and this G, so like the best thing which we can predict from the data. And this middle part that will cancel out. So in order to cancel the middle part out, consider the full loss. The full loss is an expectation over these squares. So the full loss is the expectation of this square plus 2 times expectation of this plus an expectation of this square. And now what I claim is that this middle element will cancel out. Why is it? Well, if you consider the expectation of t conditional on x, then this g x minus t is 0. Why it's so? Well, this g x, it doesn't depend on t in any way, right? So we can just take it out of the expectation. So it will be gx minus the expectation of t conditioned on x of t, right? But well, gx is defined exactly as this value, so this is a 0 thing. So what we did, we decomposed the loss into two components, and the second is some kind like of a label noise, like the errors in the data set, and it's called an irreducible error. That's nothing we can do with it, and that's there is no point in talking further about it. It's some error which the model will never be able to fix. But now let's do the more interesting part. Let's decompose the mean square error between the model predictions and the averages of targets for given x. Now, what we are going to compute the average average over, we will compute the average over all possible data sets. So let D be some data set which is obtained by sampling from this data generating distribution. So these predictions, they now depend on the training data themselves. So what I do is I make the predictions to be dependent on D, where D is the data set. So when we have a data set, we would train the model by using, for example, SGD or something, and we would get a set of weights. So instead of the weights, I'm writing the data here, right? So to illustrate that for different data sets, the prediction would probably be different. Now let's decompose this square error by again, very similarly, by considering this quantity, expected prediction for the data computed over different data sets, right? So if we trained a very large number of models, then this is the expectation of these models for a given point. So this depends on X, but it doesn't depend on any other data. This is like the mean output, what the training of a model gives us for a given X. Now, similarly to before, we subtract it and edit, and then decompose the loss into two terms, three terms. One is again a squared, then there is two times a b, and then b squared. And similarly as before, we will see one of these, that one of these elements will cancel out, and that will be this middle one again. Why it is so? Well, look at this value. It's the expectation over all the data sets of predictions for the data set minus the mean prediction. Well, this mean prediction, it doesn't depend on D. It does not. So we can take it out of the expectation, which means this simplifies into this. And now this is just the difference of the two same numbers. So this is zero and this cancels out. So what we have done is we have decomposed this error into two components. So I will describe them in detail on this second page. So these are the two components. And now if we consider the original loss, if we consider the origin, oh, this should be definitely T. If we consider the original loss, then it decomposes into three parts. The third one is the irreducible error, which we cannot do much about. And then there are these two parts. So this first one, that's the difference between the average prediction for a given X and the average of targets. Like this is the gold prediction. This is what we want to predict. So this is like a systematic difference between what on average the trained model predicts and what it should predict. So this can be interpreted as the bias of the prediction squared. So this is the bias term. And then surprise, surprise, the middle one will be variance. But actually, like this is the prediction minus the expectation or the mean of the prediction. So that's a squared. So that's what the variance is, right? The random value minus the expectation of the same random value, the same square. So this is the variance of the model. So how does the predictions differ if we change the the data sets? So this decomposition, it's called the bias variance trade-off. And it shows that the loss decomposes into these three terms. It worked for the regression and the mean square error loss. In case for classification, well, we can use the same mean square error loss on the probabilities. So then we would have like a systematic difference in the predicted probabilities and the variance in the predicted probabilities. But it's possible to derive analogies for the cross entropy losses or for the 0-1 loss. The 0-1 loss, that's like an accuracy. So it's zero if the prediction is equal to the target, and it's one if they are not. So it's possible to do it. It doesn't look as nicely, and I won't show you how it looks, but if you are interested, there is this reference to the paper which shows exactly how does it look. Now, this is still true and fine. What is not that great is that this decomposition has been long interpreted as the following, like the price for achieving low bias means our variance has to increase. So the price for getting low bias means paying for it by having large variance. And that's why this is called a trade-off, right? Because the idea is that we either have to have large bias or large variance, but we cannot make them both small, right? So that's what we are trade-offing, like we are choosing which of these components will be large. Now, the reason why people start calling this trade-off, because for some model, it actually is a trade-off. For example, here, consider a linear regression, where we want to, like the green function is the gold one, and the red are the predictions. And the red are the predictions of 10 models, or 100 models, each trained on a different training data. And the model uses L2 regularization. So if L2 regularization is large, high, what does it mean? It means that the capacity is small. And in this case, you can see that the predictions, they are very close to each other, right? So the variance is small. Unfortunately, there are large systematic differences between the predictions and the real data. So the variances, the biases are large. Now consider the other extreme where the L2 regularization is small. That means that the capacity is large. Now, if you look, we can see that the variances of the in different predictions, different prediction functions trained on different data sets is large, while the biases are virtually non-existent, right? It seems like an unbiased estimator. And of course, somewhere in the middle, we can get to a situation where both of these will be kind of small, but still it will look like there will be both zero, but there'll be some bias and some variance. Now, if we would like to see how the regularization strengths affects the testing error, then here are the graphs which plots the results for different capacities. So for different regularization strength, and you can imagine that that's actually a capacity. Inverse of capacity. So what does it look like? So with the variances, you can see that when we increase the strength of the regularization, so when we decrease capacity, the variance decreases. So that's why there is this straight red line. When we decrease capacity, then the bias, on the other hand, that's the blue line, the bias increases. And now if we sum these two, then we get this violet curve. And now compare it with the testing error. Well, the test error very nicely follows these quantities. Well, it should, right? Because the loss is the sum of the square of the bias variance and the irreducible error, which is always the same. So this is, and there is like a sweet spot somewhere here, right? Where the bias and variance is the smallest. And that corresponds very well to the place where the generalization error is as small as possible. So This is how this U-shaped curve came to be, that when the model complexity increases, then probably the bias decreases, right? Because we can get better and better results, but we pay for it with the high variance. The idea the interpretation was that if we have a small capacity, then we have some small family of models. So when we train inside this family of models, then, well, because it's small, there is some chance that it's far from, at some distance from the function which we seek, right? So having a model with a family with small capacity means we have to pay by high bias. On the other hand, the variance is smaller because we just cannot move outside this small family, right? But if we have a family of functions, like a richer one, which corresponds to the model with higher capacity, then when we may cover the data in question better. So there are solutions here which have a very small or even zero bias. On the other hand, we pay for it by increasing the variance, because the family is so large, then there is like a higher chance that we will just choose some of these models. So this sounds nice. It seems interpretable, and so the people said, "Okay, that's true." And this is just a bias variance trade-off, and that's it. This is also true, for example, for the KNN search. In the KNN search, we can decompose the loss into two terms, which are actually directly the bias and the variance. And we will see that this K, the number of neighbors which we use to search, to consider in this search, will play the role of the trade-off. So either the bias will be high or the variance will be high. So what the mean square error of such KNN search look like, I'm not showing you the proof, I'm just showing you the formulation. Then the error is composed of three elements. The first is the difference between the real target of a point X and the average of K targets of the nearest neighbors of X. So this is, in a sense, the bias, right? So like a systematical difference between what we predict, that's here, and what we should predict with the Gauss output is squared. Then there is this part, and this sigma squared, that's the irreducible error. So the variance actually corresponds to the irreducible error divided by K, right? So if K is small, then the bias is zero, ideally, because like we look at just one point. So the target for this one point should be the real target which we care about. So the bias will be very small for K1. On the other hand, the variance will be very high for K1. Now, when we increase K, the variance will go down, but the bias will go up because we consider more and more targets of points which are farther and farther away from the original one. So that is a reasonable assumption that they will be different than our targets. So these are the results from a paper by Gemann, 1992. And then, for example, for the KNN search, they show what the variance looks like. And you can see that it's decreasing. So it's really highest for K1, and then 2, 3, 4, it really goes down and it looks like 1/K. On the other hand, the bias is increasing. Now, when we combine those together, bias squared plus variance, we will get the following error function. So we can see that once again, it's like a U-shaped, and it seems there is a sweet spot here. So there is a trade-off here. We need to find a reasonable middle value of K so that none of these terms is large enough. The very similar curves work also for the kernelized regression. So this is like the kernelized linear regression using the RBF kernel. And you can see that it works similarly, but instead of the k, the number of neighbors, we use this, like the, this is 1 over gamma in our notation. It's actually 1 over 2 gamma in our notation, or 2 over gamma, yeah, like this. But generally, this is like the distance in which we consider the examples, right? So the if we look to just the short distance, we have low bias, but high variance. And if we consider more and more points, the variance goes down and the bias increases. So this was the paper which like voted for this interpretation that it's really a trade-off and just what you need to pay for low bias is high variance. Funny enough, the paper shows also the results for a single layer hidden network. And it says that it follows the same trend. And they even have a full paragraph which tries to convince you that it's the case, but it doesn't look like it, right? The bias goes down, but the variance should really go up if this should be the case, right? But if you look at it, it does not really look much like that. There are 2 points here which are not high. So what they say is they say that it's not perfectly demonstrated, and they think that maybe it's overfitting, or maybe they didn't converge, or maybe they used, or may just stop the training too soon or something, right? So they like say, okay, we think that it should look like this, and for some reason we weren't able to get these results. But the funny thing is that it's actually not true. What's not true, to be exact? What's not true is that this needs to be a trade-off. Of course, the error can be decomposed in these three components, that's true, but this trade-off kind of suggest that the if we decrease bias, then this variance must increase. But there is nothing in this decomposition which tells you so, right? Of course, if the overall error should be the same, or if we knew that the error doesn't change, then of course increasing bias will decrease variance and vice versa. But it can easily happen that the models with large capacity will have both smaller bias and smaller variance. Of course, it's not true for KNN search because of this decomposition. It also doesn't seem to be true for the linear regression, but it doesn't mean that this needs to become like an universally accepted claim. Even if you can see that the third graph in the paper didn't look like it. So in practice, people have realized that for like the models with the neural networks, it seems like the larger the model, the better, right? So instead of this unbiased estimates having higher variance, it seemed that at least under some circumstances, increasing the model capacity decreases both the variance and the bias. And there is a very nice and influential paper from the end of 2018, Reconciling Modern Machine Learning Practice and the Bias Variance Trade-off, which shows that the reality is a bit more complicated. So this is like the usual idea of underfitting, overfitting, and locating this point. And what the paper shows that, well, there is something more happening on the right side. And what's happening is that after this increase, there is another decrease of the testing error, which can go further lower than this point. So in the like traditional machine learning, we try to find this point, but there are models where increasing the capacity enough can get you here. And at that point, there is no reason to decrease the capacity anymore. You can just use whatever large model you actually want to use. The interesting thing, of course, is like why this spike, right? Like, what is this threshold? What is this magical number? This magical number is a place where the capacity, where the model first reaches zero training error. Right? That's the idea of this point. For example, consider the example from our first lecture. Here we try to run the linear regression on these blue points. And now we had some kind of a testing error. But then at some point, something happened here, right? What happened is that the capacity of the model increased to the level that for the first time, it was able to fit the training data perfectly. Like we used the polynomial of the degrees so that there was like exactly one solution which could fit all the training points. So the training loss went to zero and the test loss skyrocketed, right? So that's what this magical border is. However, if we then continue to increase the capacity of the models, or at least some of the models, then the model is overparameterized, and it is actually possible to use this larger capacity to come up with solutions which will generalize good or even better than here in this limited case. So why would that be the case? So consider these red points, and we want to solve the linear solve a regression task by using some neural network with 40 units in the hidden layer, so 40 rectified linear unit features. So such a solution might look like this dashed one, right? So it perfectly fits the points, but unfortunately it is very non-smooth, right? So it seems that it would generalize tragically in these points. But instead, consider a rectified linear unit network with 4,000 features. And of course, there are many solutions. So what we can do is we can add the L2 regularization so that we choose the solution which has the smallest weight as possible. And if you do it, you will get the black line. So you can see that the black solution is much smoother than the one than the dashed one, right? Because we have so many components, and we want to like use each of the component a bit, right? That's what the L2 regularization does. It instructs to use all of these slightly. Then you can see that the result seems to be much smoother. So that is the indication why this increased capacity might be actually good. So let's look at some results. These are the results of classifying NIST, actually some subset with 10,000 examples. Here, what we use is the random feature function model. So we generate random feature functions, and then we fit the resulting linear regression model with these functions. Now, these are the training errors. And these are the testing errors. So you can see that there is this spike here. Two interesting things. First, the error is nearly 90%. So at this point, the model does nothing, like really nothing, because a random model will get 90% error, right? 10% success. So that's exactly what the model does exactly at this point. Now, this is the 10,000 random feature functions, which is actually it's NIST with 1,000 classes for 10 of the classes, right? About this thing. So this is exactly in a place where we can like first fit the training data exactly, right? Because it's exactly the first time when the linear equation or the set of the linear equations will have the first perfect solution. So at the point, it does nothing. But then you can see that it improves, and it improves further, even better than here in this previous area, right? So using 60,000 random feature functions get us to a solution which is better than the one here in this U-shaped curve. But of course, the L2 is used as well. And this is the 0-1 loss, like accuracy. This is the square loss, like the difference in the probabilities. Here you can see what the norms looks like. So it's increasing. Now when it hits this threshold, it's the maximum. And then because we are overparameterized, we can once again keep make the values be smaller and come up with obviously smoother solutions. In the paper, they also show the results using the single hidden layer neural network. So once again, you can see these spikes here. And they also show the results for random forests. So this was very interesting and nice paper showing that like what we have come up with is not like all of the truth. But the thing is, why didn't people came up with these years ago? Like people are training neural networks, the large training neural networks. Why these spikes didn't appear? Well, it actually is a bit tricky to make these spikes appear because by default they wouldn't be there. A year later, after the previous paper, there was another nice paper which is called, or it's like demonstrated this deep double descent. It shows this double descent curve for very deep neural networks. And it shows that even for these models, it's actually possible to get the spikes, to see this effect, but you have to be careful. Like as practitioners or as engineers, we have come up with the ways of training the models to like avoid the issue, right? So like regularly we were using tools or procedures which like mask the fact that this double descent curve is actually there. So let's look at this graph. So here you can see the test error, the more blue, the lower the error. And these two dimensions, this is the capacity of the model. And this is the length of training. The model is some convolutional neural network with 18 layers. So like a huge thing with hundreds of thousands of parameters. But the parameters of course increase with the here in this direction. It's not that important, but the interesting thing is that if you fix the capacity and then train for longer and longer, then you can actually see this double descent, right? The testing error goes down. Now it increases and it goes down again. We can also see the same shape, but in this direction, right? If we fix the training length and we increase the capacity, then once again, we go down, increase, and go down further and further and further. So it seems these effects actually happen. But consider, for example, the situation where you perform early stopping. So whenever the model starts to deteriorate on the development set, we stop the training. If we do it, then when increasing the capacity, we would choose this volley, right? And this, if you look at it in 1D, this doesn't show you the spikes, right? It just gets better and better performance with the increasing capacity. So if you do the so-called early stopping, what will happen is that you will see this red curve, right? Even if the different training lengths would give you these curves, where some of these have this double descent shape, then if you use early stopping, then you will not see it because you have like deliberately chosen to stay in this deep volley. But what does this generally mean is that if you really are aiming for the best solution, then instead of trying to be confined to this area, it makes sense to get here. Again, this point, like generally increasing both the training length and the model capacity should be really beneficial. So there are, of course, there are many, after the original paper with the double descent came up in 2019, there were like 5 or 10 theoretical papers analyzing the situation for different model family and so on and so on and so on and so on. So if you want to read it, read about it, there is a lot of literature. If you want to read about the deep double descent, like how this is actually present in the model which we train, there is the link to the paper or the name of the paper, so you can Google it and read it and so on. But that will be everything from me at this point. So thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy Christmas, and Christmas is coming, so have a Merry Christmas. Also have some vacation or some pause, really just relax. I wish you also a Happy New Year, and we will meet on the last lecture on Monday the 4th, I think, of January. There will be no practicals on Wednesday because it's already holiday, so no more seeing us before the Christmas. There will be one new assignment, which will be on the Gaussian mixture, but it will be really a trivial one where you will just rewrite the algorithm similar to the k-means. So it's these last examples from assignments from this and the previous lecture, they are just simple ones where you just fill in the missing parts of the algorithm, and then you can play with it, you can try running it, you can plot the results, see what's happening. So that's the main idea. So there will be no explanation necessary for the assignment actually, and the deadline will be at the end of the semester, of the examination period of the semester, so lots of time for it. Okay, anyway, thank you for your attention. Enjoy the rest of the day and also the holiday, and see you around. If you have some questions, then I'm here, but feel free to go. Bye-bye.